Okay, welcome back. Glad you're along. We had a fascinating, as always, conversation with Clifford Carnicom Monday night. This is part two of that conversation. We have a number of items yet to cover. And welcome back, Clifford.
Good evening, Jeff. Well, I sure hope I can hear you. I have seemed to have a problem with the phone. It got better during the night last time we talked. I'll always do my best, as you know, but if I have any problems, it would be because of volume and or fading. I don't know why.
All right. Can you hear me all right now?
So far, it's okay. Yeah, we'll see how we go. Last time it turned out just fine.
All right, very good. Now, last time, Monday night, and for all of you who listen to the archives, you can go listen Monday night if you care to Clifford, and I urge you to do so to catch up on the first part of this, which really revolved around a report that made its way to Clifford, not easily, by the way, but it made it to him, and that was important because what it was a laboratory analysis of rainwater made from rain which fell on rural Minnesota. And from that spawned much of the conversation, and we're going to continue and follow up on that tonight. So, Clifford, go ahead and add. If you want to do a little recap, you can, whatever. We have plenty of time.
Jeff, thank you very much. I thought that I might do that. Just take 2 to 3 minutes to summarize the main topics that we talked about without going too into them in detail.
Very good.
And that was the first topic was we talked about a documentary that is now available to the public on the website, being distributed by the public and owned by the public. The second topic we talked about was a couple of photographs that showed in a very direct way the state of our atmosphere taken under really the most ideal conditions, weather conditions, that could be had. And even under these conditions, we saw a rather pitiful state in really the most beautiful places of the earth now, including the Grand Canyon.
Indeed.
And then we brought up the topic of that lab test and discussed it in some detail and its comparisons to certain reference values that I have. And the basic result of that test is that it shows what appear to be very high levels of calcium and potassium. And then we went on to discuss that that's not necessarily so simple as we might think it is, and it would be rather feeble to conclude that because it's something that we commonly have heard of, that it's necessarily good for us, because it gets a little bit more complicated than that when you consider the physical properties of those particular elements and how easily they are ionized. And so we spent some time talking about that, and I won't go into a repeat of that discussion now, but it certainly may come up again as we're talking. And then I somewhat prematurely introduced what could be the end loop of our discussion, and that was a revelation that that same individual that had that lab test done was 2 months later turned away by that same lab.
Right.
In fact, I talked to this individual just a couple day or two ago to clarify the tenor of the conversation as that process was terminated. But here you had a lab that basically said, we can no longer do that work for you. And there was absolutely no explanation given. There were also very uncomfortable pauses and hesitations in the conversations that took place.
Yeah, we can fill in most of the blanks, I think.
I'm sorry, I lost that, Jeff.
I say it's probable we could fill in most of the blanks with valid speculation.
Yes, that's right. And sure enough, it is exactly as reported. The service has been terminated without any explanation or logical reason whatsoever in a rather uncomfortable conversation on the other end.
Now, just to keep in mind, folks, what we're talking about is the termination of services offered to the public or anyone else by a laboratory, which does, among other things, analyze water. In this case, it was analyzing rainwater. All of a sudden, they said, we don't do that anymore for you. We're not going to do it for you under any circumstances. Goodbye. And that was about the end of it.
That's correct. And it was a paid-for test by a private individual.
Yeah.
So that's about where we ended, and we went through that lab termination paper in detail. And I suppose we're about one-third of the way through our conversation, maybe close to a half. And the next topic that comes up now, it's going to involve two papers that I wrote. And this is fairly detailed, and I'll try to be careful and not get too detailed about it, because there's actually some even more important information I think comes after it. But the papers I'll be speaking of, they're a follow through on the basis of this lab report, and that is an environmental sample that started with rainwater. I've done some thinking about that when it came in, and I made this hypothesis that because of the ionization properties of those particular elements, it would seem reasonable that you would also begin to detect higher ion levels in rainfall samples. In other words, if these particular elements are there and they're fairly easily ionized mm-hmm. with the energy from sunlight, then it's reasonable to think that you might find higher ion levels within rainwater also. And what ion levels will translate to is conductivity. Conductivity is directly proportional to ion concentration. I think that's a fairly accurate statement that could be made really regardless of the medium. Ions means that there are additional electrons in the medium there, and electrons are what cause current to flow. And conductivity is directly related to ion concentration. So tonight, as we start talking about ion concentrations that are being uh-huh. measured in the atmosphere, right. there is a translation and an analogy that can be made with that, that people might wish to also think in terms of conductivity. So what I did was began a whole series of tests involving rainwater. There'll be two sessions of this. The first involves a series of environmental tests that now extend to rainwater for conductivity, as opposed to just the air, which I had done some work before. And then another set of tests that involved soil testing. And I had never done this work before from the standpoint based on ion concentration, and right. certainly not the soil at all. I've done some rainwater testing involving electrolysis and precipitation. So I'll discuss the findings of the work related to conductivity levels of rainwater first. And the process was generally this. First of all, you're dealing with very difficult quantities to measure. Remember, I don't have a resourceful lab here other than what I'm able to round up with my means, and so I have to do the best I can. I'll usually back it up with some study before I begin the work. And I started out by asking how am I going to do this study, because all that I really had available was an ohm meter at that time. And I did some studying, and right at the beginning, it became apparent to me that there were some difficulties using an ohm meter to determine conductivity. And by the way, an ohm meter is a device that measures resistance. Mm-hmm. And resistance it's basically the inverse of conductivity. So if you have one, you would be able to get the other. And so I knew at the beginning that a ohm meter would not be the best device to do this, but nevertheless, it's what I had. And so I did conduct a whole series of tests with that instrument, knowing that there might be some weaknesses in it. And that weakness is going to eventually be rather interesting to us, I would say, because I eventually tried to seal up that weakness through the use of an alternate method. So I conducted a series of tests, and the general method was to create a series of calibrated salt solutions. And we're dealing here with very weak solutions. Right. And one of the first things that is helpful to learn is that salt in the rainwater is not a good thing. And it doesn't have to be a lot. You're not supposed to be having salt in your rainwater. It's going to lead to issues of saline stress in plants. It's going to lead to issues of accumulation of salt as water evaporates and accumulation of salts in the soil. So not a great idea if you think that the water is going to have increased salt levels. So I start by creating a series of calibrated salt solutions, very weak, very carefully measured, to determine the range in which this measurement should be taking place. And this is done, and I end up with a whole series of results. And even though my instrumentation may have not been optimum for this, I did the best that I could, and part of your way of compensating for that is making multiple tests. So I made many tests to try and bracket in the uncertainty that I was dealing with. And I had a certain set of results, and the indication at that point was that we may be dealing here with something that is higher than is expected.
Okay.
At that point, I was uncomfortable with the being in the position of not having the proper instrumentation to determine this in an absolute sense.
Frustrating is what it is.
Yeah.
It's pretty mildly.
So I inquired as to whether or not I would be able to obtain a calibrated conductivity meter, and fortunately I was. They're not too expensive, they are accessible, and I did acquire one. I purchased a calibrated, I was the one that calibrated it, but a conductivity meter.
Excellent.
And it's a wonderful device to have. I would encourage people to go ahead and try and pick one up. You can get one for certain less than $100.
Stand by, Cliff, and we'll be right back. And Clifford Carnicom, of course, doing all this at his own expense for all of us. So we can learn what's being sprayed in our skies. Back with more in just a moment. Okay, and we're back with Clifford Carnicom, who has acquired, he's telling you in his narrative, another piece of equipment to help him do what he does so brilliantly well. And I hope all of you who care about the skies and our environment, and let's not stop with the skies, because as the sky above emits all sorts of things that shouldn't be there, where do those things go? They go down to the soil, and we're going to get to that too. Go ahead, Clifford.
Thank you, Jeff. So what I wanted to do here was, after acquiring this meter, I wanted to find out if my results with a calibrated meter would match all the work that I did with an instrument, although I knew I had some weaknesses, hopefully would still be fairly good with the numerous repetitions that I made and the bracketed work that I did. And so I conducted those tests, and the results were that that initial work I had done using a resistance method was actually very good. It was accurate with all levels and all samples that I used, with one exception, and the exception is interesting because these were a series of calibrated solutions. The results would match, but with the rainwater tests, the results were really not exactly the same. They were not, my initial work was determining conductivity levels that in the end are higher than they actually read. Now, it's very important to be truthful with work, no matter where it leads.
Right.
And one always has to be careful in latching on and making assumptions prematurely. So I just issued a statement that something is not as high as I initially thought to be.
Mm-hmm.
That does not make the conclusion or position that everything is okay, by any means.
Correct.
As we, I think, will see.
Mm-hmm.
But the results were different. For some reason, the results with the rainwater were a little different. And those solutions, by the way, we're talking about very weak solutions, and I'll tell how weak as we go along here. So the next part I think that's helpful to mention, and it's true that this is a more complicated section to describe, but I'll go ahead and get the information out early in our discussion. The next section that's helpful to describe is what the weaknesses of the first method are. In other words, using an ohm meter or resistance meter to determine conductivity.
Okay.
I'm going to mention what those weaknesses are.
Now, let me ask you to do one thing. We're talking, I don't leave anybody behind here. Conductivity vis-a-vis the atmosphere that we breathe. What? Give us a little overview of why we should be concerned about conductivity and how it might plug in. I don't want to jump down the road too far, but we're talking about conductivity. Why is that important?
No, I think that's absolutely fine. You know, what is this about? What's the purpose of it? The air in its natural state, certainly in the lower atmosphere, has very little ability to conduct current. The number is incredibly small. in the units they use, you've got 14 zeros and then a digit.
Wow.
So the air in its native state, in the lower atmosphere, in the natural state, if you believe that this Earth has a natural state that has purpose and meaning in our lives, is not conductive. It's very, very...
It virtually is not. It's a non-conductor.
It is. And the reason is there are... the ion concentration and what they call the electron density in the lower atmosphere is not high.
Okay, all right. Now, that's fascinating. Now, that was very important. Okay.
Now, as you get up to the ionosphere, the layer that surrounds this Earth, call it roughly 60 miles above,
right?
That's an entirely different ballgame up there.
That's why HARP is pumping up so much energy into the ionosphere.
The ionosphere is just entirely different. And there's a quote somewhere on my site taken from a UK university, but small amounts make a big difference. The statement from the UK university is that less than 1% of the matter in the ionosphere is ionized, but that 1%, that fraction of a percent, completely alters the electromagnetic characteristics of the ionosphere. Completely.
Only
1%. Such that the ionosphere is one of the most profound and fundamental physical entities that surround this planet, and completely affects anything related to electromagnetic propagation. The whole, you know, you're on short wave, right? We hear you because of the ionosphere. The storm systems, okay, magnetic storms from the sun, will tie in with the ionosphere, the protective layers around us. The ionosphere is an extremely important medium, which represents a completely different environment than the lower atmosphere in most cases.
Which is what the U.S. military has been investigating for decades now. How to use it, how to put material up there to achieve all kinds of different programs, which is what they're doing.
So, you know, so where this leads to is that if you have the situation where the electron count and the ion count has been increased in the lower atmosphere, then you raise the prospect of conducting operations that normally would be confined to the ionosphere, namely electromagnetic phenomenon. You open up the very real possibility and really expected events of enhanced and increased electromagnetic operations in the lower atmosphere, where we live.
We're extending the ionosphere, or creating a second ionosphere, but down low where we are.
You know, that. So I hope that helps a little bit.
It does.
In terms of explaining that.
Very
now
good.
Going back to what are the weaknesses of using an ohm meter to measure a conductivity of a solution?
Okay, we'll
the weaknesses
that.
Are mentioned as two. The first is that of what they call heating, and the second is that of polarization.
All right, I
was aware of that early in the game, but I didn't exactly know how it might affect things.
Okay, all right, well, let's review that in just a moment. We have to pause. We'll come right back. This is, again, extremely important, and I know all of you listening keenly are aware of that. Those of you who may not be aware of it, pay attention, please, because our lower atmosphere has been basically reconfigured to do things it never naturally would do or could do. And who's doing it? Well, we are, in a sense. It's those black ops guys and military folks who want to turn everything they can into some kind of a weapon or defensive system if possible. Back with more in a minute. Okay, right back with Clifford Carnicum, talking about our lower atmosphere, our upper atmosphere, and all things above us, at least within the realm of the planet Earth in terms of atmosphere, and how we have been playing games big time with the ionosphere and now the lower atmosphere. Apparently for the last 6+ years, we've called the operations chemical aerosol spraying. Some people call them chemtrails, whatever you want to call them. They're not normal. We don't even know what blue skies are anymore, and that's a sad state of affairs. Go ahead, Clifford. We understand very clearly where you're going, I think, with this. We're looking forward to it.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm going to go ahead and jump in and proceed to what, to me, is the more complex interpretation of this particular work, and then I'll come back and actually make some simpler statements. But what I was after in the end here was, at least a part of what we're discussing right now, is explaining the difference as to why the results with this ohmmeter in these very weak saline solutions was different where everything else was matching as clean as could be. And the issue that was coming up was that I knew by using this ohmmeter that I was introducing a very small electric current into this saline solution. And apparently it was affecting things, but in a way that was very difficult for me to understand, or to really interpret at that point. Mm-hmm. Because the weakness of the solutions we're talking about is very important here. As you start having a lot of salt in the water, it becomes very, very predictable. And I'm going to go ahead and mention this because it's a little bit unusual in my work, but I'll go ahead and let people know how work sometimes proceeds. This was a case where I did not have an answer. I really had no idea, after all that testing I did, how I could be having a difference with just that group of samples. There are about three times in my life, Jeff, that I have resorted to what may be considered as an unconventional method of accessing information, but it is a method of dowsing, and I'm 53 years old now, and there are three times in my life where I have been involved in dowsing, and started when I was 26 years old, so it's not happening too quick. or too often, but this was such a case where I pursued a dowsing action to investigate what possible reason might explain this phenomenon.
Right.
All I can say is these three experiences in my life are rather fascinating, and it's not something I do very often, but there seems to be a time and place for it, and this seems to have been one.
Dowsing is a very important tool in the hands of the right people.
In this case, I conducted that dowsing test, and it was done in a very specific manner because of past experiences I had. So I wanted no ambiguity in this. Mm-hmm. And I also had no time. Part of the reason this was done, I did not have the time to ponder over this for months. I needed that particular answer so I could get on with the rest of the work. And out of this dowsing action came a curious word. And the word was, let's say, very specifically arrived at. And a word came to me. In fact, as it was being conducted, it wasn't even known it was a word to me. The word was, or the letters, would be L-M-O-D-E. Now, when that was done, I absolutely had no understanding of that word, had never seen it before. I used to do a lot of GPS work, and I thought there might be something related to frequencies with that in terms of the term. But basically, I didn't know anything about this term. It was a new term for me to see entirely. Now, if you start investigating the word L-mode, it ties in with a phenomenon that is called ohmic heating, or Joule's heating.
Spell it. Ohmic.
And ohmic heating or the L-mode part?
Ohmic.
Ohmic would be O-H-M-I-C.
Okay.
Ohmic. Yeah, ohmic heating, as in an ohmmeter, that type of thing. Resistance heating.
Got it.
It was already fascinating that this word that I had literally no knowledge of, never have encountered in my life that I know of, already showed a rather interesting connection to one of the very weaknesses that was specified in using an ohmmeter, and that is the heating that takes place of the solution. And furthermore, if you investigate ohmic heating, it applies very much to a plasma state. There's two ways that it's used, one in terms of conventional wire or solid material, but ohmic heating, or this L mode, applies to a plasma state. And here's a short definition. This comes straight from a NASA site. The definition of this, ohmic heating. In plasma physics, the energy imparted to charged particles as they respond to an electric field and make collisions with other particles. Rather fascinating, because it actually appeared to be exactly the very phenomenon that I was seeing. In other words, there was an agitation, there was an increase in activity, an increase in conductivity through the process of introducing an electric current, into an extremely weak saline solution. There are analogies that can be made between a fluid and a gas state, very strong analogies. And therefore, the phenomenon that I'm talking about occurring in a liquid is not at all far-fetched from considering in a more generalized plasma state, a plasma being an electrified gas. So obviously, it was a little bit complicated at this point. But I have to say that it does appear to be the best explanation I can arrive at for the variation in the results that I had. And then there was a curious circle that was reached, because as I investigated ohmic heating further, having never heard of that ELMO term to begin with, which even led to it, in doing the research, this is sort of the irony, but I was actually led to my own research. And that was, in doing all my searches, I eventually came up with a paper that I had posted on my site.
How ironic.
Several years ago, and guess what the paper was? The paper was the patent by Bernard Eastland for HARP. And if you read the patent by Bernard Eastland for HARP, you will find a very specific reference to the use of ohmic heating for increasing the conductivity of this modified environment. And what a fascinating circle, let's say.
Indeed.
Of research that followed here. And I'm not saying, you know, this was not necessarily conventional, but everything here except for that one arrival of that term was very conventional and very prolonged studies. And so a couple of more things on this ohmic heating, which that is this. You know, if you take a piece of metal and you heat it up, the resistance increases and the conductivity increases.
Okay.
I hope that people will just take a second with this, and it is what happens in a metal form. If you take a wire and as you heat it up, think about it, it starts getting hot, right? As you put an electric current through it,
right.
It starts getting hot.
Right.
And if it gets hot enough, you can melt it. But the point is that a wire, as it heats up, the conductivity decreases. This is our common experience in life, that if you heat something up, the conductivity decreases. There are a few things in life, and they're not very many from what I can find, that do not behave this way. And guess what one of them is? Salt water.
Okay.
If you take salt water an electric current into it.
Hold there. We don't want to get... Let's think about salt water. Then we're going to think about what's in the atmosphere, our lower atmosphere. And think about what Clifford has been describing in terms of conductivity. Think about HARP. Think about what we talked about earlier vis-a-vis the ionosphere, how they're trying apparently to recreate that at a much lower level to do things. And we'll be right back with much more. Back with Clifford Charnicom. I think we're all beginning to understand now the science that has been assembled by Clifford to make the case that it is rather obvious that the lower atmosphere has been turned into something that it didn't used to be for reasons that we are going to make a pretty good stab at before this conversation is complete. Go ahead, Clifford.
Thank you, Jeff. And so what I did was now introduced salt water and how it is very interesting, somewhat unique, and that there are analogies between weak saline solutions and the plasma state and an electrified atmosphere that has salts as an added component.
Okay.
That's what we're working with comparing here.
And remember the atmosphere, just to repeat, our lower atmosphere has virtually no conductivity available to it.
Yes, it's a very low, very low number.
All right.
So salt water is fascinating in that if you introduce an electric current into salt water, not electric current, if you heat up salt water, okay? Remember we said if you heat up the wire, conductivity decreases?
Yep.
If you heat up salt water, the conductivity increases.
Oh.
It's really quite, it's fascinating from a physical side, but it's like a complete flip of all nature that we know in our common world. But if you increase the temperature of salt water, the conductivity increases. And that is opposite to most things that we are familiar with. Now, the reason that this is important, or where this whole thing led to, was that there are now two physical mechanisms that I would identify by which the conductivity of the lower atmosphere has been increased. The first was postulated quite some time ago. It is being borne out by the testing and discussions that you and I are having now. The first is the ionization, photoionization, the ionization by light of certain metal groups, particularly those of group 1 and group 2 of the periodic table. That ionization would increase the electron density of the atmosphere, therefore create a more conductive environment. What is interesting here is that you actually have a second mechanism, and that is if you pump an electric current also. So this means you now have an external source of information, and we're going to be talking about that because it looks like indeed there is an external source of energy, not information, an external source of energy that is also being pumped into that environment, and it is an electric current, an electromagnetic wave, and therefore, at least conceptually, there would be an increase in the temperature of that gas, and therefore the conductivity would increase even further than it would be from the electrons alone. I hope this makes sense what I'm saying. In other words,
it does. Are we approaching conductivity levels on a par with the ionosphere at this point? Are we getting...
Well, I missed the last half, but I think I know where your question is going. I'll give some absolute numbers here in terms of what I'm finding. The magnitude in the lower atmosphere appears to be roughly a factor, call it four to eight. 4 to 8 times higher than is expected. And what's also interesting here is I did work 3 to 4 years ago with a Van de Graaff generator, actually fairly simple in terms of the physical device needed, a straight measurement of what's called a spark gap. And I made my first estimate of the increase in conductivity probably 3 years ago to 4 years ago. And that is the number you'll find on my paper, is that the estimate is roughly 4 times greater. The work of this, testing conductivity of rainwater, is leading to exactly the same result. The numbers that I have, the expected conductivity of rainwater is on the order of roughly four, what they call microsiemens. It's a very small unit, but roughly four. Okay. My numbers are on the order of 15 to 25, okay? So I'm being fairly conservative always in my estimates, and it looks like as a minimum we're dealing with a factor of roughly four in the lower atmosphere. The two other points that can be made on this discussion to follow through would be that a person can now, for the first time, make an estimate of the actual salt content of the rainwater using these conductivity studies. What you're measuring are the ions in solution. So for the first time, we can actually get an estimate of the amount of salt, literally the physical amount of salt. And admittedly, that salt is in, let's call it a generic form, because my only calibration reference right now is salt water. Actually, I use seawater, as a reference. And, one can determine the physical, at least make an estimate, first time an analytic estimate of the amount of salt in the water. The number that I come up with is 0.04%. Remember that any salt in rainwater should be viewed with a level of trepidation. It is not a good thing. You know, we know of alkali salts accumulating in the desert.
Sure.
It accumulates, and you do not want salts in your rainwater. And rainwater, by the way, is supposed to be one of the most pure forms of water that there is. And we talked about references of Los Angeles and Alaska last time.
Right.
This same thing. Here's how this relates to that. For the rainwater up in Alaska, a person expects roughly a milligram of water of these solids. And in Los Angeles, California, that polluted air, you expect roughly 4 milligrams per liter. My work leads to an estimate of 15 milligrams per liter. So everything is saying that this postulate of there being increased salts in the atmosphere continues to be borne out no matter what method I approach it at, whether it was a Van de Graaff generator from years ago, whether it's rainwater tests. They keep saying the same thing.
I understand.
One other thing that can be concluded from this report, and that is not only can you now make an estimate of the salt concentration in the water, but that can be extended to make an estimate of the salt concentration in the air. Not in a liquid form, but in a solid form. And the basis for that method is that water can, air can only hold so much water at a certain temperature. That's what humidity is about, right? The higher the temperature, the more water it can hold.
Right.
So if you imagine taking a few drops of rainwater, ask yourself, how much air would it take to absorb that and to hold that moisture? That's the idea behind it. And you can translate it to where you're making an estimate of the actual solid material in the air. And I've done that. The number comes up at 95 micrograms. I know these are units, so I try to put them in perspective. But the clean air standards, if you go looking at the EPA standards for air, you're looking on the order of roughly 50 to 75 micrograms per cubic meter. And this work is indicating that those standards may well be exceeded. And I don't think it's a stretch to imagine that that is the case. And my position is that there is a reasonable basis for having the air quality standards of our atmosphere now tested for and certified on a regular basis. And the unfortunate truth is that those governmental agencies that have the authority and obligation to conduct those tests, I don't know any other way to say it, but they can no longer be trusted to provide factual data. We do have a government that is lying to us on a regular basis in many, many ways.
Well, look at the monumental EPA lie that you've displayed, and the whole thing is crazy.
Right. And so I believe that such tests need to have an independent auditing. That's my position and has been now for a couple of years, that the data itself from so-called official authorities cannot be trusted. And this first came up years ago when the EPA went and started to change their standards.
Yep.
It happened when the visibility standards were changed. It happened when the Air Force told a direct lie to the American public on this issue. So this is where this work leads, is that everything says this is real, this is out there, it's measurable, and it looks like it would exceed expected standards in the air, and it has enormous implications in terms of now you're going from the air to the water table, and then eventually to the soil.
Talking about health and welfare of countless millions of people here, and generations. Clifford, it amazes me to hear this, because right now, let me say this for openers. There are probably an awful lot of people who are listening to and recording this program right now who are well familiar with what you're talking about, who may be involved with the project. I mean, you're being watched very carefully. So you've got a very eclectic and interesting audience out there tonight.
I would suppose that's true, because to actually follow this data that we're talking about, we have to become educated in some details, let's say.
Got about 2 minutes until the break.
Okay, that's fine. I think what I'll do next is I'll introduce this next paper, and I won't spend nearly as much time on it. And I may come back after break and go a little bit further into it, but I'm not going to spend as much time. Mm-hmm. But the idea then is to not now stop with the rainwater, but now to start thinking about the soil. What would be the expected consequence or effect of increased salts in the atmosphere and the water table upon the soil?
Right.
And that's what I then conducted, was a series of tests of, same word, conductivity of the soil. And I started that, it took me about 2 months, I guess, to do those studies. And the results are, I'll give you the short word, the short word is that, once again, those soil tests are showing conductivity levels which are higher than I would expect. Sometimes significantly, much higher than I can find from any reference sources. The numbers are again on the magnitude of roughly 3 to 4 times greater than I would expect. The actual proper testing of soils will require some fairly sophisticated lab resources, but I can make some pretty good estimates, I believe, of what's going on.
Yes.
I do have an estimate by the FCC. It's the best estimate I can find. The FCC back in 1954 made a thorough study of the soil conductivity of the entire nation because it affects AM radio propagation.
All right.
I have some reference bases, and the numbers, again, are coming out higher than I would expect.
All right, watch where this goes, folks. Don't miss it. Next hour with Clifford Carnicom. Go to carnicom.com. If you're not online, that's carnicom.com. Be right back.